2 Kings 3, once again, if you have your Bible this morning. The mid-1800s was a time of great archaeological investigation and discovery. At that time, amateur explorers and archaeologists were scouring the Middle East for evidence proving the Bible's historical accuracy. Frederick Augustus Klein was an Anglican missionary serving at the site of the ancient city of Dibon, which is on the eastern side of the Dead Sea. A local Arab Bedouin man had told Klein about an ancient stone inscription, and Klein found the stone lying in the ruins of the city. The stone was very well preserved, about 4 feet high and 2 feet wide, with 34 lines of Moabite text inscribed on it. Klein didn't think much of the find, but he did report it to local officials. Well, a French archaeologist in Jerusalem heard about the find, and he commissioned a squeeze, and that is a paper mache impression of this stone. Once the news of the find got out, officials from France, Britain, and Germany all sought to acquire this stone. The stone at this time was under the control of the local Arab Bedouins. As pressure mounted for them to give up the stone or hand it over to the Europeans, they decided instead to destroy it. They heated it up in a bonfire, they threw cold water on it, broke it in pieces, and distributed the pieces among themselves. After that, the squeeze, or this impression that had been taken, became very important. The French archaeologist eventually managed to acquire the fragments of the stone and piece them together, thanks to the impression or the squeeze that was taken previously before the stone's destruction. Well, today the stone is called the Moabite stone, or the Misha steel, and it's on display in the Louvre Museum in Paris. And the reason that I'm talking about it today is that the contents of the engraving on the Moabite stone follows the scriptural account in the passage we're looking at today, 2 Kings chapter 3. The Moabite stone mentions the Moabite king, Misha. It mentions Israel, the nation. It mentions Omri, the king of Israel. Omri was Ahab's father and Jehoram's grandfather. Also mentioned is the Moabite false god Chemosh, and even the God of Israel, Yahweh, is mentioned by name. So it's an interesting piece of archaeology or historical accuracy to see that what we're talking about here in the Bible is also related on the Moabite stone. There's, you know, written in stone are these same facts. And so sometimes people criticize the Bible. They think it's full of, you know, mythology. Well, it's not mythology. This is an actual historical account, not only given in the Bible, but even engraved on a stone found over there in the Middle East from many, many years ago. Although the Moabite stone is a valuable historical artifact, we really didn't need it to verify what we find here in the Word of God. The Bible is historically accurate, no matter if you find archaeological records supporting it or not. Even though this is an ancient text, it still has a lot of practical things for us to learn from it today. So let's look at some practical lessons from 2 Kings chapter 3. And we will start by looking at the background here, some of these characters, and then the historical situation. So let's look at the characters first. First of all, we have Jehoram. He's the one who initiates this whole endeavor of going to war against the Moabites. He's the king of Israel. His father is the wicked king Ahab. His grandfather is the wicked king Omri. In fact, in the north, they really didn't have any good kings. They're all a bunch of pagans, or they all have at least turned away from the God of Israel. Then there's Jehoshaphat, the king of the southern tribes, or the southern kingdom of Judah. He's mostly a good king. He makes some kind of bad decisions, but overall he's a good king. Then there's the king of Edom, and he's not named here, but if you again look at the map, you can see where Edom is. It's just right below Israel and Judah. It's right below the Dead Sea. So he, along with these other two kings, go to war against Moab, and you can see where Moab is, just on the eastern side of the Dead Sea. Today we call that region of Moab, that's the kingdom of Jordan. And that city where they found the Moabite stone is Dibon. You can still go to that city. I'm not sure if it's in ruins or part of it's in ruins, but that is still an occupied city, as far as I know, there in the kingdom of Jordan. Well, we find out here that Moab had rebelled against Israel after the death of Ahab. We find from the Moabite stone, in fact, that Moab had been under control of Israel since the time of Omri the king, that is Jehoram's grandfather. And so for several generations now, Moab has been under the domination of Israel. And they had to give this tribute every year of 100,000 sheep and 100,000 rams and all this wool. And so that was part of the taxation or part of the tribute that one state would have for another nation if it was under their control. But once Ahab died, Moab decided to rebel and not pay that annual tribute anymore. And so Israel determined then in verse 7 to punish Moab for its rebellion. And Jehoram then invites Jehoshaphat to join him in battle against Moab, the rebel that had turned away from them. And for some reason, Jehoshaphat agreed. Now, what's interesting is, if you know the history of Jehoshaphat, he had agreed to go to battle with Jehoram's father, Ahab. And that did not turn out well. In fact, that was the battle at which Ahab was wounded and eventually died. And a little bit later on in that historical situation, here's what 2 Chronicles says. Jehu, the son of Hanani, the seer, said to King Jehoshaphat, now this was years before, he said, the seer, this prophet said, should you help the wicked and love those who hate the Lord? Therefore, the wrath of the Lord is upon you. So the prophet of God had to rebuke Jehoshaphat for previously going into battle with the king of Israel against a foreign foe. And yet, when Jehoram, Ahab's son, asked Jehoshaphat to go with him into battle again, in sort of the same situation, he decides to go, which is kind of a remarkable thing. You would think that a good man, a godly man, for all we can see, Jehoshaphat, would have learned his lesson and would not have gone to battle again with Israel. But he decides to do so anyways. Apparently, he didn't learn his lesson. And so you've got Israel, and then you've got Judah, and then the third country is Edom. The king of Edom also joins this alliance. So there are basically three armies or three kingdoms against the kingdom of Moab. Then we could go through the action or the plot of this episode, what's happening here. Let's briefly review the storyline. And then eventually we'll look at some practical principles. So first of all, we have the leader's misadventure in verse 9. The king of Israel went to the king of Judah and the king of Edom. And it says they fetched a compass here in the King James, fetched a compass of 7 days' journey. And there was no water for the host, for the cattle, and for the cattle that had followed them. So they make a circuit, as it were, of 7 days' journey. Now again, if you look at the map, see, Israel and Judah, Israel's to the north of the Dead Sea. There's Jerusalem, you can see. There's Judah. And so they would have to go down along the western shore of the Dead Sea, down around the bottom of the Dead Sea, and then come up through Edom, and then they would hit Moab apparently from the south. So that's what they were doing, and this was, it says, a 7 days journey. So they're on this journey, and they ran out of water. This was hard marching through desert and through mountainous terrain. And so for an army to run out of provisions would have been a very bad thing, right? If they ran out of food and water, they would be an easy target for the Moabite army. The Moabites are fighting in their homeland, and yet here come the Israelites and the Edomites and the people from Judah, and they're attacking, and now they've run out of water. And so after a few days of that, they would be out of commission, and they'd be easy pickings for the Moabite army if they attacked. And so notice Jehoram's attitude here in verse 10. The king of Israel said, alas, that the Lord hath called these three kings together to deliver them to the hand of Moab. So here he is, the attacker, and yet he's thinking that because they've come these 7 days and now they've run out of water, we're all just going to die out here in the desert. He says, alas. In other words, we are doomed. We're destroyed. We're in a bad crisis situation. But Jehoshaphat consults a prophet. He says in verse 11, Jehoshaphat said, is there not here a prophet of the Lord that we may inquire of the Lord by him? So, you know, don't lose it totally here. We need to inquire of the Lord and see what the Lord can do for us. And so then we come upon Elisha's miracle. In the providence of God, Elisha is for some reason nearby. Now remember that Elisha is the prophet to the northern kingdom. But now all these armies and all these people are down in the south. They're down at the bottom or just south of the Dead Sea. They're not in the northern kingdom anymore. They're down in Moab or near Moab. They're in probably Edom ready to attack Moab. And so what is Elisha doing there? Well, the text doesn't tell us. He doesn't normally live down there. But either he's traveling with the army or he's, we don't know why he's nearby, but somebody discovers that Elisha is nearby so that they want to talk with him. And he's reluctant to get involved. He basically says, I have nothing to do with you. You have nothing to do with me. Why don't you just go consult with the prophets of your father and your mother? But, he says, since Jehoshaphat, the good king from Judah, is there, I'll be inquired of you. I'll check out with the Lord. And so the Lord then promises through Elisha that he'll defeat the army of Moab and also provide the water that they need. And so that's what happened. Notice in verse 20, it came to pass in the morning when the meat offering was offered, that behold, there came water by the way of Edom, and the country was filled with water. So God provides this miraculous activity whereby the water comes into the area. They have plenty of water to feed them or to take care of their own thirst and for the animals as well. Then we go on to the Moabites' mistake. In verse 22, they rose up early, the sun shone on the water. The Moabites saw this water looking like blood. And so they immediately assumed that somehow the three kings in alliance had turned upon one another. They had, you know, gone to battle with each other. And now this liquid on the ground, normally there wouldn't be liquid on the ground there, right? So they see this reflection of the liquid and they assume that it's blood and they decide that the three king alliance must have come undone. I'm told that the area there is largely composed of reddish color sandstone. So as the Moabite army looked down into the valley, they saw these pools of water, probably tinted a little bit reddish, and they assumed that it's blood. And so they ran down into the camp in verse 24. They came down into the camp of Israel. The Israelites rose up and smote the Moabites so that they fled before them, and they went forward smiting the Moabites even in their country. So they were expecting to plunder a bunch of dead bodies, but when they get down there into the camp, they find out that these Israelites are not dead. They're waiting for them, and they are able to turn the tide on the Moabites and ends up decimating their land. Then we have Israel's marred victory. This is a little bit cryptic in what happened next. Notice in verse 25, well, they go throughout the country of Moab and basically destroying the land. They get to this one city called Kir Haresheth, and that seems to be the last stronghold from the Moabite army. And they attempt to destroy or to, you know, be victorious over that city, but they're unable to do so. And notice in verse 27, well, we should say verse 26, notice that he tried to break through, and then verse 27, he took his oldest son that should have reigned in his stead or in his place, you know, he was the next king in line, and he offered him for a burnt offering upon the wall. So this is human sacrifice. This, of course, is the pagans doing this, probably to Molech, their god, or to Chemosh, I guess, was the god of the Moabites. And so they believe that, you know, taking this radical step of offering the next king, the son of the king, offering such an important person like that as a human sacrifice, maybe the pagan gods would step in and help them. Then something very odd happens, or the next sentence is uncertain exactly what this means. There was great indignation against Israel, and they departed from him and returned to their own land. What does this mean by great indignation against them? Well, the word indignation is the standard word for wrath or fury. But what is the source of this wrath? There was great indignation against Israel, so we know it's against the nation of Israel or these alliance of kings. What does it mean that this wrath or this fury is extended against them? Who was furious? What was the source? What was the cause of it? Well, was it the wrath of God? Well, there's no sin going on here. We can understand sometimes that God's wrath is poured out against people who sin, but there's no sin here. In fact, this was God's deliverance, right? God had said that he would provide the water and that they would be victorious over Moab. So it doesn't seem like this is the wrath of God against Israel. Is it the wrath of the Moabites? That's about the only other option here, because it seems as if the Moabites became extremely furious against the Israelites once the king offered this human sacrifice. So it seems as if, and again, this is somewhat subjective, it's not exactly clear what's going on, that the people of this city that is being attacked, they just become infuriated more so than they had been against the Israelites and put up a real staunch defense. And so the Israelites have to go home without actually conquering that city. And so that's why it's a marred victory. Although they really were victorious against the whole rest of the nation and basically destroyed most of the rest of the nation. When they got to the city, they couldn't conquer it, apparently because the people just really became furious and enraged and did not allow the Israelites to take that city. Well, let's go on then and look at some practical lessons. What can we learn from all of this activity? First of all, we learn avoid inept leadership. The kings of Israel and Judah proved themselves not to be very competent leaders here. And we see several signs of this. When you see these signs of leadership, well, you can conclude that the leaders are not doing a very good job. First of these is failure to consult the Lord before the project begins. We find in verse 6, if we go back there, that the king of Israel numbered the people, or he mustered the people. He numbered the people of Israel trying to find out how big his army is. So why is he doing that? To see if he has enough people to defeat the Moabites. So the first thing that he does is check his physical resources. The first thing that he's concerned about is, do I have enough people to do this job? His first concern is not, am I under the Lord's blessing? Is the Lord going to bless this endeavor? He's not inquiring of the Lord to see if he ought to do this. He has no concern with the prophets. So he's just doing this on a totally physical level. When he enlists the help of Jehoshaphat from Judah, Jehoshaphat as well does not consult with the Lord. Now, he's already been rebuked by one of the prophets for doing this very same thing years earlier with Ahab. And now he has another opportunity to do it, and he joins right in. Now, again, the text doesn't tell us why he goes ahead and makes the same mistake twice, but he does, without inquiring of the Lord beforehand, okay? So these kings violated, I think, a very important principle, and that is to check with the Lord before you begin a big project. The time to inquire of the Lord regarding a great endeavor is before you start, not when you get into trouble in the middle of the problem, of the project. The book of James tells us that we ought to do this or that if the Lord is willing. And so we always submit our plans to the Lord in advance. And we don't know what the Lord is willing to do. We don't know what the Lord's will is regarding certain things. And so we pray, thy will be done. Here's what I would like to do, but I'm submitting this to you. And if it's God's will for this to happen, then we believe that it will happen. But ultimately, God is in charge, and we submit our plans to him. If we would pray about a decision or a project, or even consult our spiritual leaders before beginning a project, it would avoid a lot of problems. How many of you have gotten into the middle of the project and recognized that you're either in over your head, or you don't have the tools, or you don't have the resources, and then you remind yourself, well, if I would have just planned this better, had I recognized all the tools and all the materials that I was going to need, then I would have provided all those things ahead of time, but now here I am in the middle of it, and I don't have what I need, and I can't, you know, complete it, and it's a big problem because I failed to plan. And so if we plan beforehand, we would avoid a lot of problems. Crises develop when we fail to consult with the Lord first. And so the first thing to do whenever we're considering any kind of project, especially something like this, you know, going to war or whatever it is, we always want to consult with the Lord and ask him what he would want us to do. So there's failure to consult with the Lord, and then there's failure to provide enough resources. They get out here in the middle of the desert, and after only a week's journey, they run out of water. Well, how long did they expect to be out there? I mean, didn't they know that they'd be in the desert? Obviously, they knew all these things, and yet for whatever reason, they ran out of water. The lack of water, frankly, indicates a lack of simple planning. And so you probably heard the old saying that says to fail to plan is the plan to fail. And this appears to be a simple failure to plan. Planning is a major key to success. If you want to succeed in anything, you have to plan the work and then work the plan, okay? Crises develop because of poor planning. I once saw a sign on the door. I think it was the door to the dean of students when I was at school. And the sign said, poor planning on your part does not constitute an emergency on my part. Let that sink in. And next time your child or somebody runs to you with a crisis, you can quote that back to them. Poor planning on your part does not constitute an emergency on my part. And so usually the crises, the emergencies occur because of poor planning. And so Christians should combine these both of these ideas of prayer and planning. That is, when we're considering any large project or any decision, any major decision that we're making, how do we make those decisions? Well, it would be nice if we could just consult with a prophet and the prophet would tell us what we need to do. But in our era in which we live, you can't just go to the prophet. You can't even necessarily talk with the pastor and have him tell you what you ought to do. But what you can do is pray about a situation and submit your idea to the will of God, and then you can plan. You know, we don't know what the Lord's will is. We don't know what's going to happen tomorrow. Our life is like a vapor. But we can still make plans, we can pray about those things, and we can try to succeed in what we believe the Lord would want us to do, or at least would allow us to do. So don't make the mistake of launching out into a big endeavor with no planning and no prayer. Before you start anything, whatever, it's a big decision, especially big decisions, major life changes, big endeavors, big expensive things that you're planning to do, or even if it's major decisions like what career to pursue or where to go to school or whom to marry or anything like that, always bathe that with prayer ahead of time, submit yourself to the Lord's will, and then pursue what you think is the best way to go. So we combine both that prayer, both the spiritual aspect of things, what would God want me to do, what would be best in God's sight, what would be more to the glory of God, and what is most likely to succeed. What, you know, common sense tells me that I ought to do this, that, or the other. But when you put those together, both the spiritual side and the practical side, then I think you have a good basis for making a decision and going forward. Well, these guys did apparently neither of those. They didn't pray about it. They didn't seek spiritual consultation or guidance, and they didn't really prepare very well for it either. So these are two real significant failures that a leader should not make. And then thirdly is pessimism regarding the outcome. Notice verse 10 again. The king of Israel said, "Alas," or "Woe is me," or "Disaster. The Lord has called these three kings together to deliver them into the hand of Moab." Now this is the guy who started. He initiated this thing. And what is his attitude now that they're out in the middle of the desert with no water? We're all going to die. Well, isn't it great when you have leaders who are so pessimistic? I mean, the leader ought to be the cheerleader. The leader ought to be the one who is optimistic about the success of an endeavor. And at this time, this man is very pessimistic. He says, God has brought us out into the desert just to kill us, which is essentially what God did with his father, Ahab, who died in battle. And so now Jehoram remembers what happened to his dad and says, oh, here we are in the same situation. God brought us out here to kill us. And so he's very pessimistic. Fortunately, Jehoshaphat does not panic. He wants to consult the prophet, which was a good thing to do, but it was a little bit late. So poor planning leads to pessimism. And when you're not praying and you're not planning, well, you've got good reason to be pessimistic. So Jehoram, in particular, displayed signs of seriously inept leadership. And if you are responsible for a project, or even if you're just making an important decision, don't make the same mistakes. Pray, plan, and don't be pessimistic. Secondly, don't be intimidated by wicked people. And here we have verses 13 and 14 where we see Elisha's response to the king, where he says, "What have I to do with thee?" In other words, you've been an idolater, you've turned away from the God of Israel all these years, and now all of a sudden when you're in the middle of a crisis, you come crying to me. What do we have in common? I'm the prophet of the God of Israel, and you're an idolater. We have nothing in common. Why are you pursuing anything to do with me? In fact, over in Ezekiel 14:3, it says, "These men have set up the idols of their heart, and they put stumbling blocks of their iniquity before their face. Should I be inquired of them at all?" God basically says, you're an idolater, and now all of a sudden in your crisis you come crying to me. Why did you turn away from me in the first place? You know, if you're going to be relying on the false gods, go and seek the false gods. But apparently now that you're in a crisis, you come trying to get some help from me. So the idea almost here is that Jehoram, as a wicked idolater, has no right to inquire of the prophet of God. He further says, "Go to the prophets of thy father and thy mother." Well, who is Jehoram's father? Ahab, the wicked king. And who was Jehoram's mother? An even worse woman named whom? Jezebel. So Jezebel, remember, was the one who had killed the prophets and had set up all these places for them to worship, the people to worship Baal. So Elisha basically says, you're a very large proponent of Baal worship. Your mother and father have instituted this across Israel, and now you come crying to me. And so he says, well, you're in trouble. Go call upon the prophets of Baal. Go call upon your false god. You know, some people are like Jehoram. The only time that they think about God is during a crisis. You know, when the airplane is about to crash or when the pandemic is about to hit, well, then people cry out to God. And that's how oftentimes people see God, as kind of like a divine lifeguard. He sits at the edge of the pool. He just is watching what's going on. He's waiting for a crisis to occur. But otherwise, he just sort of stays out of your life. But when you're in a crisis, when you're drowning, then you expect the lifeguard to jump in and save you. But is that the correct image of God? Is God just sort of on the sidelines doing nothing until he's called upon? Unfortunately, that's the way a lot of people think about God. That's what they, frankly, expect of God. And we know that God is kind and God is gracious. We don't know what he might do when someone asks for his help, but we should not assume that God will have anything to do with those who want nothing to do with him. Go to the prophets, go to the false gods of your mother and father. You've been worshiping them all this time, and then now all of a sudden, in the midst of a crisis, you turn to me. Well, God might say, I refuse to be inquired of you because you're an idolater. We're not one of God's children. God has no responsibility to listen to us when we come to him. Sometimes what unbelievers need to hear, as in this case, is a stern rebuke. That seems to be what Elisha is doing here. And so we need not be intimidated by wicked people. It could be that wicked people that you know, maybe in your workplace or maybe even a boss, some authority, puts pressure on you in some ways. Well, don't be intimidated by that, especially if the person is a wicked idolater or just a wicked person in general. Refuse to be intimidated by somebody who does not know the Lord and who is very wicked in his behavior. Let's look at verse 14 and find another principle here where he says, surely, were it not that I regard the presence of Jehoshaphat, the king of Judah, I would not look toward thee nor see thee. So I think the principle here is that God may bless an entire organization because of the presence of one person. Elisha is willing to be inquired of, or he's willing to cooperate here because of Jehoshaphat, and Jehoshaphat is the good king of the south, of Judah. And so Elisha says, okay, I'll work on your behalf. I will go to the Lord with this request, primarily because of Jehoshaphat, the good king. Somebody once put it this way, little do the righteous realize how much they owe under God to the presence of the righteous in their midst. It could be that God is blessing the organization that you're part of because he's blessing you. Think of, for example, the situation with Joseph in the Old Testament. The Bible says that God was with Joseph, and he blessed everything that Joseph did, and the result was that the places where Joseph was were blessed as well. And so could it be possible that God is blessing the organization or maybe the employer that you work for because of your presence there? I think all of us should strive to be the kind of person that God would bless us, and in blessing us, he would also bless the organization that we're part of. It could be that the only reason that the organization that you're part of is succeeding is because God is blessing you. And so I think all of us want to be, or we should want to be, the kind of people that would be like that, that God blesses the organization that we're part of because God is blessing us. Next, we find the other principle here, another one, verse 16, where it says, thus saith the Lord, make this valley full of ditches. So I think the principle here is obey God's commands, even if they seem odd. Obey God's commands. God's command through the prophet was to dig ditches in the desert. That probably seemed like a pretty odd thing to do, and it would have required a good bit of work. Of course, they had thousands of people there to dig, but imagine you're out here in this sort of a valley area. It's dry as a bone, no sign of water anywhere, and yet the prophet says, dig some ditches. So this seems like an odd command, and yet, of course, they follow it. God promised to fill the ditches with water, and it says he would do this without wind or rain, at least in that location. So how did God bring the water? Well, if this is a valley, remember that God could cause it to rain up in the mountains. And usually when it rains in the mountains, that water eventually makes its way down the hillsides and it comes down into the valley. And since they had dug ditches there, that water collected in all those ditches and thus the presence of the water. So poor planning had gotten them into this predicament, but the grace of God got them out of it. God caused the rain to fall, even not in that area, but he caused it to fall somewhere else so that the water would come down and take care of them. In fact, God promised not only to provide the water, but also the defeat of the Moabite army. So we find here that obedience to God's commands is always the best response. When we do what he tells us to do, he can bless us. He can take care of us. And that's especially true when we've gotten ourselves into a predicament. Perhaps our own sinful choices have gotten us into trouble. And so what is the way out? The way out is to obey God's commands. It's to put into practice God's principles. There are people who make a total mess of their lives because of their bad choices. So how do you solve that problem? Well, you start obeying. You start doing the right thing. You do the next right thing. You obey the Lord. To avoid problems, you obey the Lord. And when you're in problems, when you're in a crisis, when you're in an emergency, the best thing to do is obey the Lord. Do what God told you to do, and perhaps he will provide something special for you. So the next time your own bad decisions result in a crisis, think about what biblical commands you have disobeyed. And then think about what biblical commands you need to obey to get yourself out of that crisis. And we know that God has the power to solve our problems because notice in verse 18, he says, "This is but a light thing in the sight of the Lord. He will deliver the Moabites also into your hand." So God caused this water to come down into this area that they had dug out, so they had plenty of water there. And this is a light thing. God says, this is nothing. This is child's play. To fill these ditches with water or to provide a victory over the Moabites, that's no big deal for the Almighty God. God can do whatever he wants. He's omnipotent. He has all power to apply to any situation. And so this is a very light thing, which means that we can trust the Lord as well to care for us when we are obedient to him. Now, God may not intervene miraculously, but we believe that God could intervene miraculously, and we believe that God can provide for us in our time of need. But maybe you need to dig the ditch before he fills it with water. Maybe you need to do something to provide for God's supply. In other words, if they didn't dig these ditches, the water would have just gone streaming right past them, I suppose, and they wouldn't have had access to it, at least not for very long. So all of us maybe need to think about, well, what do I need to do in preparation for the Lord's blessing? Maybe there's a ditch I need to dig so that when it rains, I'll have that water available for me. Maybe there's something I need to do so that when God moves in a special way, that, you know, that can be used for taking care of my need. Take care of your responsibilities first before you expect God to provide for you in an unusual way. Maybe God has not solved your problem because you've not obeyed his commands. And so dig the ditch first and then trust God to fill it with water or whatever your need is. And so this episode in Elisha's life gives us both errors to avoid and examples to follow. And if we think about the practical lessons from this text, we find several. Don't make plans without first consulting with God. Pray first and then make your plans. Obey God's commands and trust his promises. Simple obedience often prevents the problems that we incur, and often simple obedience will solve the problems. Thirdly, avoid unnecessary alliances with unbelievers. Jehoshaphat should have turned down this offer to join with the wicked king of Israel in this endeavor. Fourthly, be a source of blessing for the organization you're part of. Strive to be the cause of God's blessing on your organization. And then don't be intimidated by wicked people. Some people often need a stern rebuke more than anything else. Well, let's close in prayer.